The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dan Saratsky, sometimes called the most important web innovator in Judaism today. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reform Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reform congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking this week about heritage, where we come from, and what shapes our values as Jews. This little sojourn into self-reflection came about because of a discussion at a meeting I attended, one of the many, many meetings I have the rare privilege of attending, whether they are productive or not, mostly not so much. Anyway, the meeting was, well, it doesn't really matter what it was about, but the discussion there brought up some interesting thoughts. Where are you from? They asked. I don't really mean where were you yourself born or raised, although that's a big part of who we eventually become. I mean, where are your people from? That is, where did your family come from? It's the kind of question we Jews tend to ask of one another somewhere along the way, or at least we Jews of a certain age do. Where are your parents from? Where are your grandparents from? When did your family immigrate to the United States? What did they do in the old country? And so on. These questions are a little bit generational. Nowadays, I think most younger Jews believe that they themselves are the first generation that has ever mattered. But maybe I'm just getting old, or it's because my kids are turning into teenagers. Anyway, the question of what heritage is and what it means to each one of us seems to me to continue to be very important. I know, of course, heritage would be important to me. I'm a rabbi and therefore a professional representative of heritage. But heritage is also something personal, very personal. And the discussion in that meeting focused on the personal. So, whether you want it or not, here's my personal heritage. As we Jews sometimes define it, my mom's parents came from a small town, a shtetl called Krynek, in an area known as Russia, Poland. They called it that because it changed hands so many times between the two countries, based on the most recent war, that the local residents gave up trying to figure out any national identity at all, and they just called it Russia, Poland. In any case, they knew that first and foremost they were Jews and would always be regarded as such by the local Christians, who were never going to consider them countrymen no matter what larger nation controlled the area at the time. So both my maternal grandparents immigrated to the United States as part of the huge Ashkenazic Jewish migration that started in the 1880s and went into the 1920s. My Zadie Lou came before World War I, in part because his socialist brothers kept getting in trouble with the reactionary and repressive Tsarist regime in Russia, getting involved in some way or another with revolutions. My grandmother, my Bubby Dora, came to America after World War I. She spent at least part of the war in Belgium, I think, acting in a Yiddish theatrical troupe. Both were from this little village of Krynek, but they didn't meet until they came to America. Then they got married and set up a restaurant and catering business in New Brunswick, New Jersey, right across the street from Rutgers. To this day, my mom cannot make food for less than 30 people at a time. That's the consequence of growing up in a kosher restaurant and catering business. On the other side, my dad's father came from a small village outside of Minsk in White Russia called Lehi. He was a Talmud scholar from an early age, although he was the son of a shoemaker, a cobbler, not a particularly learned man. My grandfather was part of the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment movement, from his teens. He studied in Hebrew as well as Yiddish. He came to New York around 1905, worked carrying stoves on his back up four flights of tenement stairs, learned English, read extensively, and decided to become a Reform rabbi. went to Cincinnati, Ohio, where they trained Reform rabbis in those days. They still do. Got ordained, moved to Chicago into a congregation, and then came back to Cincinnati on the faculty of that same seminary, HUC, for 35 years, becoming an important Reform rabbi, teacher, and leader. My dad's mom came from a mostly German-Jewish family from the Rhineland area, a town called Rheinach, I think. There was a bit of Sephardic blood in the family, a Portuguese-Jewish branch called Del Banco that had fled from Portugal in 1496 and made its way to Germany over the Alps. But in every other way, my dad's mom's family, they were German Jews. They immigrated to the United States in the mid-19th century and owned a store, maybe a few of them, in the California gold country called Reinhardt's, the family name. I actually saw one of those stores. They eventually settled in Portland, Ohio. My grandmother grew up there. She decided to try to become the first woman rabbi around 1910. But Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati was not quite ready for that. They didn't ordain a woman for another 63 years after she tried, and so she took classes there instead and met a rabbinical student, my grandfather, and eventually married him. That heritage does not exactly make me who I am, whoever that is, but it certainly plays a part. I mean, my three siblings all have the same heritage. None of them have become rabbis or cantors or Jewish professionals. But still, as a third-generation rabbi, a second-generation cantor, a sixth- or seventh-generation American Jew, one point I figured I was also a sixth- or seventh-generation Californian, but I guess now I'm a first-generation Arizonan. Anyway, it all figures into the equation. Who we are as Jews, particularly American Jews, to one degree or another, comes out of who our parents and grandparents are or were. So, on one side, I'm descended from socialist Jews who didn't much care for religion, but ran a kosher catering business and knew the Bible more or less by heart. On the other side, I'm descended from devout Reform Jews who knew Talmud, but believed the contemporary expression of Judaism should be modern. And that's without discussing the various paths my own parents took to their current level of Judaism. All of which raises the question, not about me, I mean, it's nice to hear about me, of course, but what about your Jewish heritage? If you are Jewish and listening to Too Jewish, it really has to do with your sense of identity. In fact, it's true whether or not you are Jewish, for heritage is personal and relevant in surprising and unique ways. Who we are is not just the result of our own immediate life experiences. It's also, to some degree or another, the result of our ancestry and the culture we come from. And when we are proud of that heritage and connected to it, well, it creates something very special indeed. But whatever our heritage is, we Jews, and those who appreciate Judaism and Jewish heritage and great Jewish programming like the Too Jewish Radio Show, we can all agree on one thing. Israel has been the homeland of our heritage throughout our history, in our hearts and minds, if not always on the ground. In that spirit, and in the spirit of the recent Yom HaAtzmaut celebration of Israel's 63rd birthday, here's the lovely song Eretz Eretz as a play-in. A sun-filled land of milk and honey, the land of the Torah, the land that I love, Eretz Eretz.
Eretz 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 tchol ein av Ve'ha-shemesh la-kidevash ve-chalav Eretz ba-nolad Eretz banichye, veneshev baiye, masheiye. Eretz shenohav, hilanu emevav. Eretz shelaham, eretz leolam. Eretz banoladnu, eretz banichye. Iye masheiye. בדרום חולות ומזרח למערב נושק גבולות ארץ שנוהב הילה ומבב ארץ של העם ארץ לעולם ארץ בה נולדנו ארץ
That was Eretz Eretz, a tribute to Israel. We'll come back on Too Jewish in a couple of moments and meet our terrific guest. Don't turn away.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. When I was in junior high school, the best kisser in the eighth grade was Julie Mills. How did I know she was the best? Well, the truth is, I didn't. Because I was pretty shy back then, and including Julie, I only kissed a total of two girls. But to me, with my limited experience, Julie was the best. My point is, we almost never know when something is really the best because we haven't experienced everything else. And so it is with pizza. Sure, every day we hear Mama's Pizza is the best. It feels good to hear it, but still, we don't relax and take it for granted. After all, we're competing with a lot of pizzas out there. So, if you haven't tried Mama's Pizza yet, we humbly invite you to do it today. We believe you will think it's the best, and you'll remember it forever. Just like I remember kissing Julie Mills. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is an independent school for children from kindergarten through eighth grade. It has a long-standing track record of academic excellence and an unparalleled integrated general and Judaic studies curriculum with a variety of music and fine arts classes combined with the award-winning sports program THA nourishes students in body, mind, and spirit. The atmosphere in the classroom encourages self-assured self-expression, critical thinking skills, and respect for diverse points of view. THA's low student-teacher ratio allows its highly qualified faculty to provide instruction based on the most up-to-date proven research methods in science, technology, math, and literature. THA students understand the relevance of Jewish values in the modern world. THA sees learning as a way of life and builds a strong sense of community. They are enrolling now. Please give your child the gift of a THA education. For more information on how to enroll your child and to schedule a tour, call 529-3888 or visit thaaz.org. That's 529-3888 for THA. We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Dan Saratsky. Dan has become an innovator in Jewish online web blogging. Some people call him the most important web innovator in Judaism today. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm going to ask sort of a weird question to start. If Egypt can have a revolution started by Facebook, what do all of the new social media imply for Judaism?
Well, that is in some ways a general and not a specific question. I think it implies a lot for a lot of different reasons. You know, there's so much going on in the community in so many different aspects, culturally, politically, religiously. And there's implications for every aspect of Jewish life. It depends on what lens you want to look at things through. I mean, social media has led to a revolution in congregational life, for example, by helping give rise to the independent minyan movement by making it easier for people of, you know, diverse religious backgrounds to find each other and start new communities together. It's been really helpful in trying to bring together people of similar political ideologies and trying to help them foster new movements. So, for example, J Street has been very successful because of its ability to do online organizing. You know, in the cultural space, you know, there's been a boom in new Jewish cultural innovation with projects like J-Dub Records and Heat Magazine that really were able to build new audiences through the internet. So social media generally has really had an impact all across the spectrum, and it will continue to for some time in the future.
So speaking as a, you know, now I'm an old guy. I turned 50 this year. I used to be the young person who was adopting all these new technologies. It causes challenges, too, for established Jewish organizations. If you're a synagogue, you're supposed to be on Facebook. You're supposed to be emailing. You're supposed to be tweeting. And you're still supposed to do all the things you used to do.
Yeah, well, there's challenges and opportunities, right? I mean, yes, it's a challenge insofar as if you're already a strapped nonprofit organization or congregation and you don't have a lot of time or money to invest in, you know, the online, that can be a drain and really pose a challenge. But at the same time, it creates so many more opportunities for building your community, for doing online fundraising, for getting the word out about your events that, you know, there's a trade-off, you know. And I think that sort of elder, more established organizations in the Jewish community have really been kind of pushed into the corner of having to change and become more accountable to the public and more rapid in their response to community interests, community needs, and that process of kind of democratization is happening all across, you know, everything, not just the Jewish community. So it's only natural that the Jewish community will also be impacted in that way. I don't think it's a negative in the long run for these organizations to be, you know, put into this position of having to adapt and change and hire new positions like social media, you know, staffers and things like that, because ultimately it's going to help their organizations thrive and survive in the 21st century. If they fail to adapt and change, then they're going to go the way of the dinosaur.
Hoping not to go the way of the dinosaur, we'll be back on Too Jewish with Daniel Saretsky talking a great deal more about Jewish life on the web when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism of Kvetch Orkfel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us at the website or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. And now, a special visit direct from London. We welcome Rabbi David Wilfon Gingy, now in London for a year of sabbatical, which is now in its last few months. Can you tell us a little bit? By the way, good morning. Welcome.
Hi, Sam. It's great to talk to you.
Tell us a little bit about how Israel works this whole sabbatical thing.
Okay. So Israeli labor law is actually guided by Torah tradition. Yeah, this week's Parsha Bahar talks about, the portion talks about how there is a sabbatical year, how every seventh year the land needs to rejuvenate itself and rest and have a Shabbos. So Israeli law has a labor provision. If you're in a position for more than 6 years, in the seventh year, you are allowed to take a year absence from your position where they will hold your job. You have to apply for it. It's a little bit of a committee thing, but it's almost unheard of that it's not accepted. And they can't just say, you're not working, we're not going to hold your position, we'll get somebody else. The concept really is sabbatical, and it's a national thing. Now, they don't pay you on your sabbatical, but people often use, if they save up money during the other 6 years, they use that year as a time for personal spiritual rejuvenation, refreshment, maybe a year of study, a year of travel, take your family to another place for a year. In this case, I've gone to London, and I've been serving as a rabbi at the Liberal Jewish Synagogue. It's a 100-year-old synagogue, and it's the largest of the liberal movement. We have over 2,000 members, and I've had a great time being a congregational rabbi for the year for Brits, which are a whole nother breed.
And you don't mean Brits in the sense of a Bris. You mean the British Jewry.
Right, right. Anglo-Jewry, as they like to call themselves. Yeah. Interesting. Nobody here really calls themselves British. They all call themselves English. People call themselves English, British, Irish, or Welsh. British is what the outsiders call them, but the insiders are proud of their local,
very,
national.
Very clear. Yeah, it's funny how nationality doesn't die as quickly as you think it might.
No, and they like to claim they're not nationalistic, and they look down on Zionism as being sort of an old-style nationalism. But the truth is they're nationalistic and hypocritical. That's my personal opinion.
And you can say that because you're not going to be there next year. So, you know, there's a certain freedom from the general politics.
It's called freedom of the pulpit, and I try to say it straight. But actually, they're a wonderful community. I've really, really enjoyed, and I think it's been mutual as well. So that's the idea of sabbatical, that Israel has this thing that, and it's really for all laborers, that you can ask for your seventh year to be a free year. The provision is you have to come back to your job within a year. If it's like more than a year, then you can lose your job.
Right.
So I'm looking forward to going back to the sunshine and the Jaffa oranges and hearing Hebrew all over the place again.
Sounds great, but it sounds like it's been a wonderful experience. And we'll talk again soon. Thanks so much, Gingy.
All right. Take good care of yourself, Sam.
Be well. Take care. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. How are you today?
I'm fine. I'm no doubt relieved, as wonderful as Yom HaAtzmaut is now that it's in the rearview mirror. But you've got another program coming up, teaching teens to be leaders about Israel.
That is true. In about 2 weeks, we will take a group of very talented young teenagers from Tucson to a 2 days Israeli-style leadership course in memorial of Beth Weintraub. This is a very interesting retreat, as we're trying to do it in a very Israeli style, which means that the teens themselves are actually running the show. In the beginning of the event, each teen will be given a topic and materials, and they will build classes. And later on, they will instruct those classes to the other teenagers. They will also prepare their own food along the retreat and manage the whole show.
Boy, I'm impressed by the whole concept. You know, we do some of that empowerment in America, but we usually reserve it for not for teens, really. We save it for later, or we just don't feel like we can trust kids to do that. Is that wrong?
Well, I think in Israel we do tend to refer to teenagers in a much more mature way. And we tend to believe that if you refer to someone as a responsible adult, they behave as a responsible adult. And once you give them the power, you give them to make the decisions, to run the show, they surprise you. They usually do.
Is there some difference also that's cultural? Because in Israel, of course, you know, when kids are 18, they're headed off to the army. And that's not so true. Here, they're headed off to college. It's a very different sense.
I think this is part of what makes us as Israelis trust those teenagers and know that we can rely on them. Because, you know, at the age of 19, they can lead a platoon. So at the age of 17, you would expect them to be able to lead a class or to lead a field trip.
Or even pick up their clothes and put them in the washing machine.
Well, that is challenging even for more adult people, let me tell you.
Tell us a little bit about how people can find out more about this teen retreat if they want to know about the Weintraub Center's work on it.
Well, they can call the Israel Center at the Federation. And they
577-9393, is that the right
extension
number?
Extension 133 and extension 132.
See? And wonderful program, a great way for kids to learn more about Israel, but also to take leadership in that work. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Weiler of Janos J-Bar and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails is a wonderful new place, maybe the best in Arizona.
Well, we just won Best New Restaurant in Tucson.
I heartily concur. What's your favorite stuff on the menu?
There's so many things that we do well downtown. It's really the foods of the entire world. And so at lunch, we do this great pounded Laotian pounded papaya salad. At dinner, have the trout. Trout with oysters and cream corn. Late night, you got to have the downtown burger.
And you can hear great music there late night too, can't you?
You don't have to go to bed early. You can stay up late Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, listen to live jazz, great specials on the late night menu, great drinks, incredible cocktails we make there, by the way. It's in the name.
I have to say, try the Game Changer Soup too. What's the phone number for Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails?
623-7700.
Or it's www.downtownkitchen.com.
That's it.
We'll see you there, Janos.
Thank you.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been dissecting the Osama bin Laden killing, its implications for national security. I was just mentioning off air that I saw a piece on the new, perhaps the successor to bin Laden, Zawahiri, who is an Egyptian, showing him in the back of the courtroom when he was screaming on behalf of the Muslim Brotherhood after he'd helped to orchestrate the assassination of Anwar Sadat. So he's got a long, I don't want to say rich history, but terrorist history. I don't think Al-Qaeda is going anywhere. It may go further underground.
Right. On the subject of Zawahiri, some of my colleagues in the intelligence community always said that he was much more dangerous, that he was the brains behind 9/11, that Osama was merely a figurehead because he's sort of tall and charismatic and whatever. But, you know, the fact is that however many of these individuals you get, the well-known colorful ones who are on the wanted posters and who have big price tags on their heads,
the playing card ones who have $25 million.
Right. The word on the Arab street, and I think this is not far from the truth, is that for everyone you kill and make a martyr of, 10 or 50 or 100 will arise in their place. Because as long as people are disenfranchised and see the U.S. as supporting corrupt regimes which tend to disenfranchise them and tend to keep them poor and keep their countries undemocratic, you know, contrary to our rhetoric that we support democracy and free elections, in fact, all around the world, in every continent virtually, we've supported dictators who are not so clean. And we've had friends of whom we should not be so proud. And as long as we do that, there will be people who want to tear us down and who want to harm our interests. And, you know, getting one or a dozen or even 100 of the most well-known ones doesn't necessarily make us more secure. And it may, in fact, create more people who are willing to step in and join extremist organizations and engage in activities that are designed to harm America's interests and American property, and above all, American citizens. So I think we're right to sort of raise the security threat level. I don't remember what the most current color scheme is, but to warn travelers,
I think, or right. Magenta.
I mean, to warn travelers to keep their eyes open and to avoid congregating and whatever. You know, those poor people who were killed in the explosion in the big square in Marrakesh. So I was in Marrakesh, as you know, a month or so ago. That's a square that everybody goes to. And if you're a tourist, that's the one place in all of Morocco where you're most likely to be blown up. So if there's a period of heightened alert,
phenomenal place.
That's a great square to stay out
of.
Myself. And people need to use common sense when they go abroad. Just like in Yerushalayim, Kikar Tzion, it's a great place to stay away from. And there's no imperative reason to go there.
Right.
But that's where a huge percentage of terrorist incidents have taken place. So, you know, there are some places that should be viewed as having more or less permanent red flags. And I think American tourists should stay out of them for the foreseeable future. We have to continue next week more specifically addressing the impact of this latest development on Israel, if any.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Tom. Everybody who's traveling, travel safely and thoughtfully. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Three Jewish mothers are sitting on a bench talking about how much their sons love them. Sadie says, "You know that Chagall painting hanging in my living room? My son Arnold bought me that for my 75th birthday. What a good boy he is. How much he loves his mother." And Minnie says, "That you call love? You know the Mercedes I just got for Mother's Day? That's for my son Bernie. What a doll." And Shirley says, "Ah, that's nothing. You know my son Stanley? He's in analysis with a psychoanalyst in Beverly Hills. 5 sessions a week at $400 a pop. And what does he talk about? Me." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well, but don't tell your mother that joke. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, which is given its name for the census that occupies a good part of the beginning of this Torah portion. Superficially, it's just a list of names and numbers, not a very interesting text for study or inspiration. But it also teaches us a primary lesson. Every human being counts in God's eyes, and should similarly count in our eyes as well. There's an unusual phrase in the beginning of the portion. A survey is to be taken of the whole nation, b'mispar shemot, by the numbering of names. In other words, even though by definition a census is an accounting, a totaling of sums, each individual is to be accounted for not by number, but by name. Each person has a unique identity, a human face. Each is an image of God. The notion that every human being counts is part of our tradition in many ways, from the requirement that we have 10 Jewish adults for a minyan to the requirement that we must view every other person as a tzelem Elohim, an image of God no different from ourselves in holiness. The Talmud tells us that one who saves a single life is accorded the merit of having saved the whole world. Each of us is counted because each of us counts. Paradoxically, even counting itself can be transformed into an affirmation of sanctity. When we do the tabulation that lets us know that we have the 10 people required for a minyan, traditionally we don't count by numbers, since that would devalue every human being into a mere digit. Instead, we find a verse from the Bible that has 10 words. We work our way through it until we have completed the passage, making every member of that accounting into part of a holy pasuk, a holy sentence. In this period between Passover and Shavuot, we even count every day. The counting of the Omer, a way to sanctify the days by counting them into importance and holiness. In a world of numbers, it's comforting to realize that we are each much more than the sum of our parts. No matter how we seek to quantify and digitize the world, each one of us, including you, matters to God. When we come back, we'll talk with Dan Saradsky, a web innovator in Judaism and someone who can tell you how to make your interconnectivity Orthodox or Jewish or, well, all the above. Find out how when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
I'm Rabbi Jason Holtz to schmooze about the Jewish news. On Sunday, May 15th, a number of Arab protesters attempted to cross into Israel, primarily from Syria and Lebanon. That is the day that many Arabs in the Middle East refer to as Nakba, or the catastrophe, referencing the reformation of a Jewish state in the historic land of Israel. In the resulting clashes with the Israeli Defense Forces, a dozen people were killed trying to breach the border. Israel and Lebanon have both filed formal complaints with the United Nations over the matter. The United States has criticized the Syrian government for encouraging the border clashes. White House spokesman John Carney said that the Israelis have the right to prevent unauthorized crossings at its borders, and that the U.S. is strongly opposed to the Syrian government's involvement in inciting protests in the Golan Heights. He went on to say that it seems apparent to us that this is an effort to distract attention from the legitimate expressions of protest by the Syrian people and from the harsh crackdown that the Syrian government has perpetrated against its own people. This coming week, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel will be in town for the annual conference of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. He is also slated to meet privately with President Obama and then address a joint session of Congress on May 24th. High in the agenda for Netanyahu's visit will be the future of the peace process. Hamas and Fatah, formerly rival Palestinian factions, have recently formed a unity government. Israel has criticized the move, pointing to Hamas's ongoing aggression against Israel. Furthermore, U.S. Middle East envoy George Mitchell recently resigned his post. In other news, an Israeli winemaker, the Golan Heights Winery, has won first place in an Italian wine competition. The Golan Heights Winery took top prize, the Gran Vinitaly, in a competition that featured 3,720 wines from 30 different countries. Golan Heights Winery produces wines labeled as Yarden, Gamla, and Golan. I'm Rabbi Jason Holtz, and that's the news of Jews.
We welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Daniel Saradsky. He's an expert on Jewish life on the internet. And I want to ask a kind of a theoretical question. Is there a kind of derech eretz of blogging? Are there certain kinds of standards for the way that people conduct themselves on the internet that's more Jewish or less Jewish?
I would say that once you become anonymous, you know, hiding behind a keyboard, you tend to be a little looser with your tongue than you might be in public or when you have to be accountable with your name attached to things. So there's a, you know, tendency towards acrimony and, you know, what we call flame warring on the internet, you know, people really trying to get each other's goats and be agitating towards each other, which is unfortunate in a certain respect. In another respect, leads to really intense conversations that might not otherwise happen. That said, because of the level of acrimony and just how hurtful and damaging things can be on occasion, there have been efforts to try to introduce, you know, kind of a Jewish ethic into the way that we conduct ourselves online. When I was still publishing my blog, JewSchool.com, I used to get into a lot of arguments with the folks over at Jewlicious.com, and the arguments would sometimes get really out of hand in ways that, you know, now that I'm a bit older and more mature, I regret. But it led to me introducing a movement called Jewish Bloggers for Ethical Speech Online. So we put pictures of the Chafetz Chaim, who is a rabbi who advocated ethics of speech, you know, at the bottom of the comments form, so that before you hit the submit button, you would see a quote saying, you know, from Rabbi Soloveitchik that said, you know, like, I may, you know, disagree with a person, but I'll never, you know, demean them as a person. You know, I'll pick the fight with their point of view and not them, you know, as a person, so that people would consider that before they hit the submit button on their comments. I will say that I have not always been personally perfect at following that advice because, you know, passions tend to flare. But nonetheless, you know, some of us are trying. Some of us do succeed and some of us don't always.
So there's a tendency when Jewish organizations try to democratize, and of course, you know, Jews are so prominent in so much of the web-based technology. I mean, from, you know, Mark Zuckerberg creating Facebook, Sergey Brin, and all of the different engines seem to have been created, if not all together by Jews, but by a lot of Jews involved. And yet when Jewish organizations try to deal with this, their first approach is usually to hire someone on staff, you know, young and energetic, you know, like you, to take it over and fix it all. That's really not the right way to do it, is it?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, I would say that some organizations are not necessarily staffed appropriately to handle these kinds of online communications in a way that is relevant and sensible for their constituencies, which will require bringing on outside staff. In other cases, it may be appropriate to retrain your existing staff to learn how to handle these things. In other cases, it may be worthwhile just bringing in a consultant to provide advice to the organization and help your staff adapt. It's really dependent to the specific need case of that organization, where they're at, what their staffing looks like, and what their internal capacity is. I think that you know, for some organizations, it's really just better off to bring somebody in from the outside. But at the same time, you know, that person needs to be properly, you know, aware of the needs of the organization, the needs of the constituency they're serving, how to properly engage with that community. So you want to just make sure that, you know, if you're hiring fresh blood, that, you know, they know how to conduct themselves appropriately within the context of your community.
Tell me a little bit about the capacity for activism, how activism is different online, because you've been very involved in a variety of activist campaigns.
So, you know, it's, you know, one of my favorite quotes is from Timothy Leary about, you know, after you tune on, you know, tune in, turn on, drop out, right, but you go and find the others. Right, and that's really what the internet's been valuable for, is helping you find the others who are out there sharing similar ideologies, similar interests, similar worldview, and coming together to form a community that can act together consciously. And so the internet's been really valuable for helping build those networks across, you know, where we may have been divided by territory, you know, spatially before, you know, we can come together online and then coalesce as a movement together. Online activism only goes so far, though. you know, the Facebook page that was the call for protest in Tahrir Square in Egypt was a call for people to physically show up somewhere, not just to congregate online. And while online activism can be very useful in fundraising, you know, and we can see from, say, the Obama campaign in, you know, the last election, how much money he was able to raise online and just how powerful of a tool it was for that. Or in other instances where it's, you know, you've been able to get the word out about things like even this, what's it called, It Gets Better campaign to help gay teens who are contemplating suicide. You know, these videos that have been produced by all manner of folks, you know, from White House officials to like Google executives talking about, you know, how life gets better once you, you know, get out of high school and you stop getting bullied for your sexual orientation, everything else. Like, that kind of activism is different from what we might have conceived as traditional form of activism, but because the internet enables us to connect to things that we would not otherwise find in our immediate localized communities, it can empower us in feeling that we're part of something greater than ourselves and allow us to connect to things that are bigger and then to take action together as a community, you know, and that's tremendously powerful.
One of the real ironies, I think, of all the connectivity is that you end up watching people staring at their palms a whole bunch. Eric Yaffe, the president of the Reform Movement, and a friend, someone I really respect, was speaking at the Reform Biennial about a year and a half ago. And he said, you know, isn't it wonderful we can all have a Shabbat where we're not connected? And as he was saying, you know, put aside our iPhones and our Blackberries. And while he was saying that, it was being posted on Facebook and tweeted like in real time. So we don't really ever shut off. Should we? Isn't that Jewish?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's why Shabbos is valuable, because it creates sacred space and it pulls us out of our, you know, our day-to-day, and it gives us an opportunity to be self-reflective and to turn off, right, to tune out for a while.
Okay,
and
so I think do you do it?
I try. You know, sometimes it can be a challenge. I mean, I don't work on Shabbos, you know, but I wouldn't say that I'm completely, you know, device-free come Shabbos. You know, I like to read the New York Times on my iPad in bed. You know, I don't necessarily, you know, want to be plugged in at all times. Sometimes I just need to take time to myself.
I don't mean to make you feel guilty about violating Shabbos on your iPad, but...
Well, I don't feel guilty because, you know, I'm a modern contemporary Jew, and, you know, I feel like you gotta pick your battles. For me, you know, using an e-reader is going to be the norm, you know, and will probably be halakhically permissible in 20 years, only for the fact that there won't be books left. So, you know, there's going to come a time when we're going to have to reevaluate our positions on all these things. And you can see that there's already conversations going on about that. I mean, there was a great article in The Atlantic not too long ago about, you know, the halakhic debate over e-books and using, say, like electronic siddurim on Shabbos and things like that. And, you know, I have like a sitter app on my iPad, which won't let you access it on Shabbos. And, you know, I think that things like that are a matter of personal choice. And, you know, if you're a Reformed Jew, I would, you know, say that obviously it's about informed choice. And so in that case, you know, you should be free to use your iPad on Shabbos, especially if you don't view it as work or a violation of malachot, especially if you're post-halachic and you don't care about malachot.
Well, what if we, you know, just make it so the only apps you can use are your Siddur and your, you know, Jewish study apps on Shabbat?
That'd be one way to go also, wouldn't it?
Unlikely,
I think it's fascinating, you know, because this is such a you know, a hot issue right now, because things are so rapidly changing, right. And they're only going to change even more radically.
Yeah, it
over
seems
the
to me
next
like 20
years.
This isn't as fast as it's going now. It's not going to slow down.
Oh, no. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the topic of transhumanism, but I'm giving a talk on this at this upcoming Jewish Outreach Institute conference called Judaism 2030. What I'm talking about is this idea that within 20 years' time, we're all going to have like chip implants that are going to enable us to download the entire Talmud to our brains and, you know, be able to telepathically communicate with each other and, say, have a minion across, you know, territorial space where we could all be up the Kotel at once if we wanted to. Like, everything is going to so radically, drastically change in 20 years' time that the world as we know it now is going to be completely different. And what that's going to say for, you know, Jewish community and Jewish learning and Jewish practice, you know, is only, you know, starting to be perceived of by folks like me. But the majority of folks in the Jewish community aren't even looking at this stuff yet. And, you know, we're always playing catch-up in the Jewish community. We're always 10, 20 years behind, you know, the trends and everything. But, you know, in this case, things, you know, it's so difficult for Judaism right now to just compete with all the distractions of new media, be it television and internet and video games and things like that. Imagine when you have, you know, this capacity in the future to be connected to everything at all times in the like the direct physicality of your body. Judaism is going to have a really hard time distinguishing itself from everything else that's available out there. And I think people need to start thinking about that now, right? Like, how can Judaism distinguish itself as content from everything else that's happening in the world that at some, you know, in some ways is more appealing to young people than Judaism is?
So here's my question. Jews have been pioneers in technology, and particularly in internet and web-based technology, as I think I said earlier. You know, there was a book called The Talmud of the Internet that was out like 20 years ago. We've thought about this a lot.
Well, I mean, a lot of the Jews who are leaders in technological innovation aren't religious and are, in fact, avowedly atheists and have nothing to do with the Jewish community in any meaningful capacity. And I think a lot of the reason why Jews are overrepresented in kind of the leadership of technology organizations is because we're overrepresented in anything we take an interest in. You know, we just happen to be a people who excel in the things that we commit ourselves to, whether it's economics and finance, or if it's law, or if it's government, or, you know, whatever it is.
Well, there is an exception in the NBA, but there are two Jewish guys in there, so...
Right. Well, that's a fair point as well. But nonetheless, you know, we seem to thrive in anything we take interest in. And so I don't think there's anything particularly special about the relationship between Jews and technology that's, you know, distinguishable from, you know, the relationship between Jews and anything else. I think there's other things that may be, you know, there may be more of a kind of a explicit connection. But at the same time, I do think that for me personally, there are, you know, specific connections that exist and that make a lot of sense, and that, you know, I use technology as a way to express my Judaism and my Jewish identity, and I think that there's a lot of people in my generation who feel similarly, and so it's starting to change in some ways. There's a lot of, you know, new innovations in Jewish educational software and, you know, social media and whatnot that's, you know, bringing Jews together across boundaries, that's bringing, you know, Jewish education, which has been for a very long time kind of inaccessible and unaffordable to a lot of people. It's making it more accessible and more affordable, and so that's, you know, having an impact. And, you know, you see things like this Jewish New Media Innovation Fund, and now Natan, which is another grant maker, is working on a New Media Innovation Fund. Right? There's much more of an interest now in the organized Jewish community in investing in technology, and therefore you see a lot more of these kind of young Jewish technologists who are cropping up, presenting new ideas for how technology can transform Jewish life. I think that, you know, is empowering and, you know, kind of really shows us where we're moving towards in the future.
I want to thank Dan Saratsky for a great visit here on Too Jewish. How can people find out more about what you're into right now?
Well, you can always visit my website at danielsaratsky.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at mobiusonesky, mobius1ski.
Thanks, Dan, and we'll check back in with you, find out what's happening next. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Rabbi Jamie Korngold, the adventure rabbi, talking about her new book, The God Upgrade. Our playout this morning is a classic from the great Yiddish folk singer Theodor Bekel, a former guest of Too Jewish, the Yiddish, I don't know, love song, Dona Dona. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Eufen fuhr liegt der Kelbel, liegt gebunden mit der Strick. Euch in Himmel flieht der Schwelbel, freit sich, dreht sich hin und zurück. Lacht der Wind in Chor, lacht und lacht und lacht. Lacht der Opa Toga ganzen und eine halbe Nacht. Donna, 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 donna. Donna 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 dai Donna 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 dai
Schreit das Kälbo, sagt der Poher, wer je heißt dich seiner Kalb? Wolls gekendo seiner Feugel, wolls gekendo seiner Schwalb. Lacht der Wind im Chor, lacht und lacht und lacht, lacht der Opa Toga ganzen um a halbe Nacht. Donna, 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 donna. Bidne Kälber tut men binden und men schleppt sie und men schächt. Wer sot Fliegel flitt a rauf zu, is bei keinem nit kein Knecht. Lauter Wind in Korn.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.